Trained first as a pilot, then a journalist, Frederick Forsyth finally turned to fiction and became one of the most lauded thriller writers of our time. As exciting as his novels are, Forsyth's autobiography is a candid look at extraordinary life lived to the full. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Frederick Forsyth to the show. Good morning, Frederick.
Good morning, Bill.
I did call it an autobiography there, but you don't like that term, I don't think, for this particular book.
Well, it's just that the word autobiography implies pin accuracy and research and scholarship, and I don't have any of these things. So I use the word memoir because it comes from French, okay, but it means memory, what you remember.
Yes.
So that was the way I wrote it. I just sat down and thought, what the hell happened? Oh, I remember.
And it's almost kind of a series of vignettes, isn't it, that have a plot behind them?
Well, that's the idea.
It's
about 50 anecdotes. It's hopefully the sort of stuff you might get over a dinner table.
It's quite a life you've lived, Frederick. And as a lowly private pilot with an instrument rating, what a thrill it must have been to be in the RAF as a pilot at 19.
I was obsessed from the age of about 5 onwards with aeroplanes. I mean, all the went back in the Second World War. Wow, I bet you don't remember that, Bill.
No, I don't.
But I mean, the icons for a small boy weren't pop stars. They weren't even sporting stars. They were the fighter aces. So my playroom walls were daubed with the names and the faces of the great fighter aces of the First and Second World War.
Wonderful.
And it stayed with me all through my boyhood, my schooling, and despite all the discouragements, I insisted I am going into the Air Force. So eventually I did, 1956 to 1958, very luckily, because, you know, there are a lot of tests to pass, and I managed to get through them. And one day, in March 1958, an Air Vice Marshal pinned those lusted 4 wings on my chest, and that was it.
Fabulous. And what were you flying?
A thing called a Vampire.
Oh, lovely.
A Helen Vampire. Now, museum piece, the guys who flew it, but never mind.
Did you do much flying after the RAF, or did you kind of stop then?
Well, no. What happened simply was I became a journalist on, as we know, we've both been there, a miserable little salary. Private flying was expensive. I couldn't afford it. Then I went abroad. License expired, and to renew it, it's not like a car license,
which is good.
Filling out a form, it had, you know, meant doing the whole thing again, and somehow I never got round to it.
Yeah, I've done it 4 times, having it lapse and have to do the whole thing over again. It's a real pain. Now, you mentioned that you were a journalist. You started, as many do, a local newspaper in King's Lynn, and eventually found your way to the wonderful world of Reuters.
Well, yes, it was, Fleet Street then was the mecca, so to speak.
Yeah.
And most kids out there in the provinces said, one day I'm going to go to Fleet Street. It was a lot easier to say than to get in. Mm. I don't know how they do it nowadays, but back then you had to have experience. You had to be pretty qualified. You had to spend time in the provinces. And even then, they just looked at you in the lobby and said, I'm afraid the editor doesn't see newcomers. So out onto the street I went until I had one wonderful break. I met a guy who also was trained at the Eastern Daily Press in Norfolk. And he took me into the PA, the Press Association. And there I had an interview, and the guy said, what in the other? I said, well, languages. He said, you speak language? I said, yeah. Well, what? I said, French, German, Spanish, Russian. And he picked up the phone. He just rang somebody inside the building, and he said, Dune, I've got a live one for you. And he sent me up 2 floors from the PA to Reuters.
Fantastic.
Which, of course, for me was, believe it.
You mentioned in passing there.
I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. This was a building entirely full of foreigners.
Well, exactly. But you mentioned very briefly in passing there that you speak French, German, Spanish and Russian at this point. How did that come about so young?
Well, that was the foresight of, no pun intended, of my father. Right after 1945, he was a member of Rotary. Rotary had a kind of a linkage with France, the French Rotary, and so I got sent over to stay with a French family. They spoke not a word of English, and so what French? After 4 long summer holidays staying with this wonderful family, I could pass for French.
Fantastic.
So then he did the same with a German family, and so that was it. And then I went to school where they happened to have a Russian-speaking master who gave Russian lessons, so I took Russian up to O level. If people remember O level.
I remember those very well.
Yeah, O level that. And then I called Spanish. I came down to, I had time to kill before the RAF would accept me. Spring of 56, I came down to Malaga. Mm-hmm. And spent 3 months there. Again, I refused to go to the hostel where they would all be speaking, all the other students would be speaking English, you know, the Danes and the Swedes and the Americans, the Canadians.
Yeah.
And so on, but all the common language, English. And so I went to Professor Don Andres Oliva, marvelous man, wonderful man. And he listened to me with a wry amusement. And he said, well, if you really want to stay with the Spanish family, I think I can probably fix it. And he did. So I spent the whole 3 months of that spring, January, February, March, 56, with a Spanish family just around the back of the Miramar Hotel in Malaga.
Fantastic.
And came out speaking rapid Spanish.
That's the way to do it, isn't it? Immerse yourself in the country.
It's the only way. And yeah. When you're young, you can pick up languages. You can go to all the language schools you like in middle age. It's not the same. You'll always have a terrible accent. But when you're a kid, you just soak it up like blotting paper.
Obviously very useful indeed as a foreign correspondent, but were there times that you had to mask your fluency so that people around you wouldn't twig that you knew what you were talking about?
Well, particularly the east of the Iron Curtain, yeah. Mm. That was where it was pretty clear that if I let them know I could pass for German, among Germans, and just disappear, they wouldn't take it very kindly.
Yeah.
So I affected this sort of Bertie Wooster, incompetent, stupid English git act, with a terrible accent and awful vocabulary.
Love
so they nodded and thought, well, he'll be no problem. You know, exactly where he is. Then I used to slip through the slip my tail,
yeah,
and disappear into East Germany.
Fantastic. Now, eventually, as many do, myself included, you ended up at the BBC and you discovered the vast bureaucracy there maybe wasn't to your taste.
Well, yes, it was, maybe a mistake to go, but I thought that, I'm going to, with Reuters, that the future of journalism maybe was in broadcasting radio TV, no longer the printed press. And so I switched to the BBC. Okay, that was fine. We did radio reporting and TV inside Britain. It was when I was sent abroad that I ran into what you might call office politics. And the then, I don't know, it still exists, then sort of a slavish, obsequious obedience to the establishment in the form of the Foreign Office and the Commonwealth Relations Office. They sent me to Nigeria. I didn't report what they wanted to hear. So how that went.
Yeah, and I think it was the coverage of the Nigerian civil war was a kind of tipping point for you.
It was indeed, yeah. They had a guy in Lagos, and they sent me to the other side, Biafra, which of course they refused to call Biafra. They called it the rebel territory.
Mm.
So okay, fine. But they told me what was going to happen when I got there, and what the situation I would find, and what I found was absolutely and completely different because the report had been written 400 miles away in Lagos.
Yeah.
So when the Lagos propaganda ministry began sort of propagandizing, they were winning hands down, and the BBC said, well, can you confirm this? And I said, no, I can't, because they're not. Back then, they weren't. They did eventually, but it took 2.5 years, Bill. You know, it was supposed to be a 4-week war.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be a little intertribal spat.
Yeah.
No casualties worth the name would ever occur, and the Nigerian army would wrap the whole thing up within 4 weeks. Well, it work out like that.
Yeah.
But once the establishment has dug its heels in, it takes the view it cannot be wrong. Well,
yep.
It damn well can. It usually is, actually.
Indeed, indeed. And so you decided to take the risky route at the time of authoring a novel, and of course it's a very slow way of making money if you make it at all.
Well, this was it, but I didn't know that. I think sometimes, you know, the really innocent, the truly naive have some kind of guardian angel, maybe, because I thought, hey, I really thought you took a manuscript down to the publishing world and sold it like a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about royalties.
Mm.
I thought, well, I'll make some quick money, and then I'll go back to journalism. Yeah, not quite like that, because, you know, I wrote the book, The Jackal. I went back to the days, in my head, I mean, of when I'd been with Reuters in Paris, when the OAS was really trying to shoot Charles de Gaulle, and failing to do so, and I had devised an idea that they would never succeed unless they brought in an outsider, a professional with a sniper scope rifle. That might, I thought, get through the rings of security around de Gaulle. So that was the way I wrote it. And then, of course, de Gaulle was still alive, so the publishing world looked at me blankly and said, what the hell are you doing? He's still alive. So obviously we know the outcome of the story. And I said, well, it's not about whether he dies, it's how near the assassin gets. So they said, no, not for us. It took a bit of hawking it around the West End, and eventually, again, another stroke of luck, met a man who said he'd agreed to read it, liked it, and then not only took it, but he said, I'd like you to do two more.
Fabulous.
I thought, wow, a three-novel contract, first time off. I mean, it doesn't get any better.
Fantastic. And were there similarities between the two careers? Was the research the common bit?
Yes, I think it was. You see, the part of journalism I always liked wasn't, an industrial strike where you stand out there in the cold and the snow with a microphone, sort of looking at strikers, or even football coverage. And so what I liked was investigative reporting, to find out what's really going on, as opposed to what the establishment, trying to persuade you is going on, which is usually a bundle of tissue, a tissue of lies. So I like that. Well, when it came to researching a novel, it's a pretty similar technique. What is really going on? Well, what's going on behind the facade? So I sometimes make the comparison that if you imagine sitting in the theatre, you're looking at actors on the stage with the grease paint and the special effects. But I would like to take the reader by the hand backstage and show him the whole grubby business.
Yes,
when
yes.
the grease paint is off.
Absolutely. And you took a lot of risks in your research. I mean, you really did get yourself involved. A famous incident in Hamburg back in 1974.
There were times in the early days. You see, I couldn't get access to the pinnacle of officialdom because I was. Who the hell's he? So I had to go in at the other end. When I wanted to investigate something criminal, I couldn't go to the police, who would be able to tell me all about it. I'd have to go into the underworld and find out. So I did. I wanted to find out what was going on in the black market arms industry. That was to write The Dogs of War, which is about mercenaries. I had all my research done, except one section, and that was how do you get black market arms into an African war. And I asked around, and the answer was, Hamburg is the center. So to Hamburg I duly went. I traced the Mr. Big, and persuaded him that I was actually a South African. I was buying on an arms buying mission on behalf of a billionaire. So I got into his innermost councils, found out what I wanted to find out, how it was done. And then, unfortunately, he discovered who I was and got a bit upset. So I got out of Hamburg in a hurry.
Yes. And is it urban myth or true that the arms dealer actually saw your picture in a bookshop window?
Yeah, no, that was true. What happened was, and it was just a fluke, the jackal came out in German while I was there. And they called it Der Schakal. Fine, okay. There was a display in a shop window, and he was in a parked car, his own limousine, right next to it at a red light. And he looked through the window, and he saw one of the books had fallen over. And there on the back was, the South African.
Oh, dear.
He had a real sense of humour failure.
What are the chances of that, eh?
Yeah.
There's a few great stories about ladies in your life, but I particularly like the torrid affair with the stunning East German girl.
Well, yeah, there's that one. That was, again, foolishness. I just met her in the opera cafe after a performance. She was undoubtedly stunning. She was alone. And, for a Westerner, it wasn't easy to score because it could have been dangerous for an East German girl to go out with a Westerner. I mean, she'd immediately attract the attention of the secret police, and it could mean things like she'd lose it suddenly. There wouldn't be a place for her at university, or her brother would be fired, or her parents could be put out of their apartment because everything was state-owned. So, anyway, she didn't seem to have any such fear at all. So we went back to my place, and we had an affair. But there was something odd about her. She would never let me run her home in the small hours of the morning. She always insisted on a cab being called up from main station. And eventually I became curious about why. So I was going past the station one day, and I saw the cab driver of a few nights earlier who'd been at my front door. And I said, went over to him. I gave him 50 Deutschmarks, Western currency, which pleased him a lot because he could then go to the special shop.
Yes.
And I said, where'd you take her? So he gave me an address. In Pankow. Now, Pankow was the kind of the Belgravia of East Berlin. It was where all the nobs lived.
Yeah.
I thought, well, that's funny. How can a corporal's wife live in Pankow and dress like that? So when I was over in the West, I did a little bit of inquiring with some contacts I had there, and they said, well, she lives there, dear boy, because she's the mistress of the defense minister. So I thought, whoops, amazing. And this guy also is going to have a sense of humor failure when he finds
wonderful.
Out, so I better get out of here.
Wonderful. Now, there's a lot of controversy about one particular thing in your book, that you ran the occasional errand for MI6.
Yeah, I know there's a lot's been made about that. I wish it hadn't, but there we are. I knew when I mentioned it that it is like a drug. It's like, you know, shoving heroin towards an addict when the media hear that word.
Of course.
But I thought, on the other hand, you know, it's been so long gone, it's so long over, and all sorts of memoirs have been written, and all sorts of secrets have been released under the 30-year rule, cabinet documents, cabinet minutes, secret discussions were held, all released under the 30-year rule. So this is 45 years ago. Mm. There's no USSR anymore. There's no KGB anymore. Well, there is, actually, but it's renamed.
Yep.
East Germany's gone. The Stasi's are gone. What did it matter anymore, thought I.
Mm.
So I thought, well, we'll put it in anyway. And the other work I did is sometimes just a little bit of ferreting, I suppose, under the cover of a novelist reporting his next book or researching his next book down in South Africa, Rhodesia in South Africa. So I thought, well, yeah, okay. Yeah. But back then, honestly, Bill, a lot of guys did it.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of guys tried to help the old country by accepting, if you like, a suggestion, a request. Look, old boy, you know, you're going to a trade fair in a rather difficult to get at situation. If a letter came under your hotel door, would you be kind enough to put it in your attaché case and bring it back?
Mm.
Well, the answer would probably be, yeah, all right, yeah, okay. I mean, technically speaking, not very wise, but on the other hand.
Yeah. I get it. I get it. There's a load of people who are bleating about it, but I can totally see your point. I really do. What a career. I mean, I'm not even going to ask you the obvious question, is there anything you'd change about it? Because presumably there isn't. It's been a wonderful life.
It's been fun, yeah. Most of it's been fun. I mean, there have been incidents that were scary at the time, now funny. Some rather moving. I put in deliberately some moving passages because there was one episode that just sort of scarred me, which was watching the dying children of Biafra die right in front of me, not on film, not a still picture, the real thing in front of me, listening to the crying and the moaning as they died, and that that made me angry that it was being allowed to happen. It was just a weird situation. I mean, so there was an air bridge bringing in relief food. It's the only mercy mission that was ever illegal.
Yeah,
because the Nigerians were trying to shoot the mercy planes down.
Mm.
So a very weird situation.
And there's a lovely quote, which I must finish by asking you about, which says, "We all make mistakes, but starting the Third World War would have been a rather large one. To this day, I still maintain it was not entirely my fault."
Yeah. Yeah, it's again another scary night. I was in East Berlin, and I had been at the flat of a charming young member of the opera chorus, and I was driving home about 2:30 maybe a.m., and I suddenly came across a Russian soldier with his hands up, meaning stop. So I stopped, and then across the intersection rolled column after column of Soviet troops. I mean, mechanized infantry, guns, tanks, bridging equipment, all sorts of stuff. And it was rolling straight towards the wall.
Right.
And, now, that time, it was thought that West Berlin, East Berlin, the wall could be the spark of the big one. And here was this huge, I mean, I estimated 3 to 4 divisions rolling towards the wall in the middle of the night. So I thought, what do you do? I thought the only answer is, look, report what you saw. Nothing more, nothing less, no comment. No assessments, no interpretation, just what you saw. So I did. About 20 folios went through. Being at that hour, of course, these Germans themselves who were fast asleep.
Yeah.
And it woke up most of the Western world. I mean, it went to the foreign ministries and the defence ministries of most of the allies and most of NATO. Fortunately, Reuters didn't publish it. It was only just at the around dawn when Moscow was woken and asked, "What the hell are you doing in East Berlin?" And they said, "Well, it's the rehearsal for the May Day parade." And so we said, "Well, why don't you bleeding well tell us?" Oh, tell anybody Thank about goodness. These things. And so stupidly, being communists, of course, they thought not to tell anybody. But it was 1 week before the May Day parade. They were having a rehearsal in the middle of the night.
Good grief. I love it. All these and many more stories, just as good as those, are in the book, which is such a brilliant read, as all yours are. The Outsider, My Life at Intrigue. And I'm so grateful to you. I know that you're not a man who loves doing interviews particularly, but you'll go back into your shell, I think, quite quickly after the promotion bit is over of this book, will you?
Back into my shell. Look, I'm 77, Bill. My interests now are really, really riveting, like, hey, sit on the lawn, have a glass of claret and play with your grandkids. Why not?
Fantastic. Good for you. You've earned it. Frederick, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Bill.
All the best. Bye-bye.